Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part 3 of The Terror Threat, or Why Are We Still in Afghanistan? I hope you'll stay tuned. We return to Robin Upton's fine audio collage, The Terror Threat. This is but one part of his magnum opus titled Black is the New White. This opus comprises around 22 hours of excerpts from the 19-year, 1,500-hour broadcast history of the radio program Unwelcome Guests. Robin has woven this tapestry together in a most interesting manner. The backbone of The Terror Threat is a brilliant speech that John McMurtry gave in 2001, at the very beginning of the U.S.-Afghanistan War. McMurtry was then professor of philosophy at Guelph University in Ontario. He argues that the alleged war on terror is a hoax, and that, by any sane definition of terror, the greatest terrorists are imperialist governments and our corporate rulers. The real goal of the then new Afghanistan war is control of the rich oil and gas deposits in the Caspian region to the north, formerly Soviet territory, now up for grabs. Fast forward 2 decades. Afghanistan is now the longest war ever conducted by the United States government. Why? Because the oil and gas reserves of the region have not yet been secured on behalf of the Western capitalist oil companies. It seems to me that the specific goal is to stabilize Afghanistan sufficiently so Western oil companies can build and operate gas and oil pipelines from Kazakhstan south to the Arabian Sea. The obvious better solution to this problem is to come to an agreement with Iran to run the pipeline through that stable and advanced country. But Iran is a regional power, and long-standing U.S. policy has been to destroy all regional powers and have the hegemon, that's us, be the only power in every region of the world. So the U.S. military, on behalf of Big Oil, will continue to do it the hard way, continue to devastate Afghanistan until it is stabilized. Then build the pipeline. Of course, the best solution of all is not only off the table, but unthinkable. The best solution is to leave the oil and gas underground in Kazakhstan. Don't pump it anywhere and don't burn it. But that's the solution to a different problem. That's the solution to saving the human and many other species from extinction. The real problem is how to make the Rockefellers and the Gettys and the other oil company major stockholders richer still, without aiding Iran. Our president is no geostrategic genius, but even he has realized that the U.S. war in Afghanistan is stupid. That's his term, and he's right. But the war doesn't look so stupid to the board of directors of ExxonMobil. To them, it looks like a very good investment. And they're not even paying for it. But I've gone beyond what Professor McMurtry said in 2001. So let's return to that and the final part of The Terror Threat.
Every step and preparation and aftermath of this whole new war with no end confers cumulatively more strategic, legal, and military control over the world's peoples and resources from an unaccountable U.S. financial and armed force center. That's its meaning. But the war with no end is not just for world dominion and, as it is humorously titled, a fight for civilization. The grand prize of this war is unimpeded control by multinational oil corporations over the world's greatest oil and gas deposits, which are located around the Caspian Sea of Central Asia, the former territory of the Soviet Union. I just remind you in passing that the war against Saddam Hussein, who many of you may recognize, was given the green light by the U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie a few days before the invasion of Kuwait. The key there that nobody ever talks about is 95% of the oil of Iraq is publicly owned, and the people won't give it up. Longtime U.S. strategic advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski counseled, quote, in 1997, unhindered financial and economic access to precisely these, quote, Central Asia natural resources. This is in the Grand Chessboard, referring specifically to, quote, the enormous economic prize of natural gas and oil located in the region, close quote. Brzezinski advised that in the face of domestic resistance, it will become, quote, ever more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues. And now I emphasize what he says following that. Except in the circumstances of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. It's the only way you'll be able to move in on those old oil fields.
118.
And at three separate points in this book, I culled quotes which I've used now in lectures in three countries. Brzezinski says that without an attack on the order of Pearl Harbor, or unless the American people felt their sense of domestic well-being seriously threatened, or without a direct external threat, they would never support the, this is a quote, the imperial mobilization necessary to control Central Asia. I mean, some of the quotes in there make Dracula look like a, somebody I'd want for a marriage and family counselor.
Whatever for dinner, pal.
It was shocking, and we have clearly seen in what Dick Cheney calls this war that will not end in our lifetimes. Our model at From the Wilderness, I think, is being proven as time goes by that this is a sequential war to control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet. And we were talking before the show, and I think it gives these latent Nazis now the opportunity to come out in full dress uniform, because we are seeing now this is such a criminal regime, and they are going forward. The more opposition starts behind them, the faster they move into totalitarian imperialist aggression.
Well, this is the doctrine of total power, and it conceive of no limit to itself. As earth events interfere in resistance to the unaccountable world rule, military and police links are forged on the very sites of any resistance. Constructing and exploiting the new system requires this enemy to justify the sweeping new powers of coercion and terror which the global corporate system requires to rule an increasingly unwilling world. As in all protection rackets by terror and financial manipulation, the greatest threat to life comes from the very system of armed force surveillance and attack, which is said to be protecting citizens from it. Conceptualized by presidential proclamation after September 11 as one in which everyone in every region are for us or for the terrorists, with us or for the terrorists. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick, in a less-known comment, explained this meaning to include precisely those protesting against the WTO. And notice it was at the height of this that this whole incident occurred. Quote, this president and this administration will fight for open markets. We will not be intimidated by those who have taken to the streets to blame trade and America for the world's ills. That's his response to 9/11. Totality of rule is not the only parameter of totalitarianism. In Hannah Arendt's phrase, limitless of power also proceeds from an omnipresent center. In the new totalitarian movement, this omnipresent directive force communicates through global financial and media control centers with Washington and Wall Street, the dominant nodes of the interlocked system. The world's means of life and mass media are the material and the symbolic vehicles, respectively, by which the flows of goods and demand for goods control the world populations. The regulating principle of all decisions is to multiply by ever more deregulation and new financial instruments the monetized circuits of power through which directive control of all of the world's means of existence increasingly pass. The telltale sign of the totalitarian movement is that it cannot stop by its nature. It careens from one life-destructive crisis and suppression to another in supreme confidence of its limitless power and capacities until its overreach exposes it to collapse or destruction. Armed terror is not the essence, but the punctuation mark of the new totalitarianism's meaning. The money and consumption commands channel is the secret of the movement's success because it avoids responsibility for all its failures. Wall Street prescribed market failures to provide for societies are instead always attributed to transcendental forces of the invisible hand, punishing these societies for alleged sins against market laws. It's probably the most dominant superstition in the history of our race. Thus, as catastrophes increasingly befall a majority of the world, the victims are blamed for their new deprivation and misery. This is a far more effective mode of rule than jackboot terror, which is more overt, but it exposes the system to another form of resistance. For such a regime depends throughout on keeping knowledge silenced and repressed. This is its Achilles heel. As soon as people see through it and flag it to the surrounding community, the collective trance which it depends on begins to come undone.
And that is, of course, a very serious flaw in the world of 2019. Do we think that it's going to get easier and easier to control information flows? Or are people going to be more able to send it where they like? There is an argument that says, yes, they're inside all these computer chips because they've nobbled Intel and all the rest, and they're just getting their system up and running, and then they'll turn on the hardcore censorship. Well, I don't know about that. Is it possible that the 5G network being aggressively rolled out could be subverted? If so, and people could really share their experiences, that could spell the end of the deep state.
It exposes the system to another form of resistance. For such a regime depends throughout on keeping knowledge silenced and repressed. This is its Achilles heel. As soon as people see through it and flag it to the surrounding community, the collective trance which it depends on begins to come undone. I'm just going to give a quick anecdote. The Royal Society of Canada had a really good conference on the World Trade Organization, yes or no, just in Ottawa a few weeks ago. The chief negotiating lawyers, trade lawyers for our government were there, as well as a member of the secretariat of the OECD. And the most interesting feature of it, as I observed them in action and in debate, they are utterly incapable of appreciating a counter-argument to any of their positions. They just blinker it out. It's not a question as they come up with the lies, although those will come. It's just a question of not being able to engage. You're dealing here with programmed people.
413.
I had the opportunity in the wake of the end of apartheid in South Africa to join a delegation that was working with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on a set of hearings they held on the professions. They held hearings on leadership professions in society. They had one on journalism, they had one on law, and they had one on the medical profession. And the behavior of the medical profession in South Africa was appalling. It not only supported apartheid politically, but undermined medical ethics to the core. Now, I should tell you that in South Africa, the white medical society thought of itself very much in the Western tradition. They adopted Western codes of ethics. You may remember the first heart transplant was in South Africa. These were not people who came from a different culture or ethical stance, except that there was a regime that was engaged in institutionalized violence against the black majority population. And so what did doctors get involved in? They got involved in falsifying autopsy reports in prisons. They were all involved in refusing to treat black patients. A friend of mine, two friends, wrote a book called An Ambulance of the Wrong Color, and that referred to the fact that if a black person was injured, for example, in a car accident, a white ambulance would not pick up the person and take him or her to the hospital because it was of the wrong color. So they would rather let people die than breach the apartheid segregation laws. And doctors were a part of this. And, of course, the ultimate was the death of anti-apartheid activist Steve Biko, who was, in his day, the leading activist, who was beaten to death in jail But before he was before he died, he was evaluated by two physicians after he'd been severely brain damaged. And the physicians essentially said there's nothing wrong with him, and they put him on the back of a truck and transported him 400 miles, during which trip he died. And the doctors were asked, why did you do this? Why didn't you reveal the extent of his injuries? And they said, well, we subordinated our medical judgment to the security police interests. We can see in this example, probably even more than in the first case, how easy it was for the medical profession to absorb the values of the larger society. And at the Truth and Reconciliation hearings, the reconstituted Medical Society of South Africa came with a kind of mea culpa and basically said, you know, we really abandoned our values because we were part of the regime, we were part of the culture of apartheid in South Africa. Now, it turns out, actually, when you look around the world, these breaches of what we think of fundamental ethical values are actually quite common.
You're dealing here with programmed people. And interesting, on the street, and then went around on the street, and I just tell a little anecdote, and here was this three-level riot police with all in their Darth Vader uniforms and so forth, and these kids playing and celebrating in a center about 40 feet from them, everybody terrorized by them. And I found myself moving towards them and standing in front of them and just trying to stare through their visors, to see through to their eyes, see through to the humanity. And then I just shook my head. When I did that, the biggest of the member broke rank, a guy about 6'5", broke his rank out of the middle of them and ran towards me and went like this with his big steel baton and said, "You're a threat. You're shaking your head." And I really think, in reflection, is not only absurd, this is the symptom of the totalitarian society we're going to, but I think he's right. If you shake your head, you are to this system. The new totalitarianism is ultimately an American confidence game, which rules the world by images and projections of power arcing over the globe's surface, while limitlessly rapacious financial sequences called free flows of capital and commodities strip the world's peoples and their life ground underneath. The evidence is all around. The meta pattern is most globally fatal with the planetary ecosystem, but it has played out catastrophically on the social level in Russia, Mexico, Argentina, Brazil, and Southeast Asia since 1990. But never is the private and centralized financial control of these operations raised publicly as an issue. Nor is the control of the money used by private investment banks and the financial divisions of corporations, whose revenues are generated on the basis of creating over 95% of the world's money demand, is created by private financial institutions.
611.
So what you have today is a new kind of a war. It's a financial war. You can get, by privatization and financialization, what armies used to get by force of arms. This is not the class war that people spoke of 100 years ago. It is a financial war. And it is a war that classical economists warned against. 300 years of classical political economy sought to get rid of landlords and bankers. 100 years ago, people spoke of technology. Nobody believed that the vested interests could fight back. But they did fight back in the way that parasites do in biological nature. I've read in the Italian newspapers coming over on the airplane that people talk about parasites. And people think of parasites as taking the host's energy and the lifeblood. But in biology, the smart parasites do something else. They take over the brain of the host. They make the brain think that the parasite is part of the body to be protected. In America, President Obama and Treasury Secretary Geithner says the economy cannot survive without bailing out the banks, without bailing out the debt, without making the gamblers and the kleptocrats whole on what they have taken. the production economy, the consumption economy, the real economy is being sacrificed to the financial sector. But matters don't have to be this way.
But never is the private and centralized financial control of these operations raised publicly as an issue. Nor is the control of the money used by private investment banks and the financial divisions of corporations, whose revenues are generated on the basis of creating over 95% of the world's money demand, is created by private financial institutions themselves. Thus, the omnipresent center of the interlocked global financial system can deprive hundreds of millions of citizens of their very means of existence or their life security overnight, through debt issuance and withdrawal of debt issuance, with no exposure of the foreign private powers behind the control of the world money supply constitutionally vested, in fact, in national governments. It's never raised as an issue. It's an unspeakable. So the question arises, where is the failed global experiment of this totalizing rule by private corporate power ever raised? Where has it ever even spoken, whispered inside our government caucuses? The ground of the silence in even social science classrooms is that this monopolist program has become internalized as a public value set. That's the key. The omnipresent center is in this way made more invisible and unaccountable as it spreads. It's inside. The public signifiers and meanings to it are increasingly ruled out in the steering media to set the public mind lock upon which this totalitarian system depends. All become secret in the war with no end to ensure closure against the public even knowing the lines of this world advance. And you notice the newest tactic, which was never available before. We're at war, Bush the other night. We're at war. Anytime any embarrassing question, we're at war. Can't talk about it.
167.
Now, back in 1970, some people wanted me prosecuted for espionage or treason because I had given information about the intelligence agencies to members of Congress, the press, and the courts. If that had happened, however, I would have had the reasonable expectation that I would be prosecuted in a federal civilian court with the usual protections of the Constitution and maybe even some high-priced lawyers. Today, you can't be so sure. The administration claims we are at war and that anyone suspected of working for or somehow associated with Al-Qaeda is an enemy combatant. Now, as we know from the Padilla and Elmira cases, you don't have to have fought in combat or even been a member of a combat unit in order to be called an enemy combatant. The label is all that suffices. Once the label is attached to you by John Ashcroft, you can be taken away from the jurisdiction of a federal court, locked up in a military brig in South Carolina, denied access to an attorney, denied access to your family, and held indefinitely. Worse, the Bush administration reserves the power, that it asserts, since it's never been really affirmed, to take you out of that brig someday and prosecute you before a special military tribunal. A tribunal that has been rigged to not follow the standard rules of evidence in either military or civilian courts.
All become secret in the war with no end to ensure closure against the public even knowing the lines of this world advance. And you notice the newest tactic, which was never available before. We're at war, Bush the other night. We're at war. Anytime any embarrassing question, we're at war. Can't talk about that. To sustain acquiescence in the sacrifices it requires, totalitarian movement must keep its subjects off balance by a non-stop succession of disruptive changes and demands.
398.
Why do we have the most mental illness of all countries studied? Perhaps in spite of the rhetoric, we don't have the right early childhood experiences programmed into how society functions in the United States of America. Could it be that in spite of all the talk, we don't have family values in place? Those are strong deterrents to having good health, both mental and physical. And of course, there are other indicators of how poorly children fare in this country compared to other rich countries. We have the highest proportion of children living in poverty, the highest rates of homelessness among children, the highest rates of death from child abuse. We have twice the teen birth rate of the next closest rich country. We have the highest rates of child injury deaths. So it should be no surprise, too, that we have the highest infant mortality rate, the highest child mortality rate, and the highest youth homicide rate. We medicate our children with psychoactive drugs such as Ritalin, Zyprexia, and Paxil, and we use them more than in other countries.
Private fear for one's security is a necessary condition across communicatively isolated citizens for their submission to such a regime. The violation of long-accepted norms presented as fait accomplis and the loss of life bearings by permanent threat to secure livelihood are the psychological operations which are at work in any totalitarian movement. To keep the majority in a continual state of inner anxiety works because people are made too busy securing or competing for their own survival to cooperate in mounting an effective response. In the past decade, the entire population of the globe has been kept permanently off balance with one financial meltdown and transnational trade fiat after another. Notice how they're moving ahead with those rapidly now. After emptying national coffers and overriding rights of the domestic self-determination, populations have been so overwhelmed by the moving juggernaut of economic and environmental crises that a rule of universal insecurity has rendered social majorities paralyzed by a low-intensity terror, the necessary condition for any totalitarian movement to continue its advance. For keeping its subjects perpetually off balance is its modus operandi. That is why in the Afghanistan case, the war no sooner seems over than the cry goes up, who is next? You have to keep it moving. Arendt's 1955 study, The Origins of Totalitarianism, is confined, quote, to the only two forms of totalitarianism we know, Nazism and Stalinism. But Arendt warns in words that are not remembered that totalitarianism is, quote, a never-present danger, grounded in the endless process of capital and power accumulation. Those are Hannah Arendt's words, which erupts past former historical and social limits by, quote, alliance with classless masses. Arendt's far-seeing overview of endless capital accumulation mobilizing as an overwhelming social force by alliance with classless masses is revealingly silent in even scholarly texts on Arendt's work. This is all part of the silent collaboration and in complacent analyses of totalitarianism as only elsewhere. The agenda of thought is rather distant rogue states or shadowy foreign terrorists which are ever ready as new pretexts for more mechanisms of social repression. The negative solidarity of atomized masses, that's Arendt's term.
Thus pretty much endeth the terror threat. All voices you heard were woven together by Robin Upton of Unwelcome Guests. Find more of this fine program at unwelcomeguests.net. More of our fine program at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, bidding good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.